You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
Hundreds of young Iraqi men are signing up to fight the radical Sunni militant group. They are answering a call to arms by the country's top Shia cleric. And this is likely to stoke already strong sectarian tensions.
From Iraq to North Waziristan to Kiev, we'll review the day's top stories here in the studio with Robert Fox and Samira Shackle. Then, as the new edition of Monocle magazine hits the newsstands, we look at our annual Quality of Life survey. Today, our editor Andrew Tuck asks, as the fallout from gentrification hits harder, is it too late to act?
Suddenly, your conversations with people hunting for their first apartment include mention of neighbourhoods you'd struggle to locate on a tube map. Remind me again, where is South Where the Fuck?
And later in the show, I'll be with Henrik Brandauer Johnson, author of Jogo Bonito, for a personal tour of Brazil's beautiful game. All that, plus an art review and a bit of music too, coming up right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy in the next hour here on the programme. Before all of that, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. US officials say they may hold discussions with Iran about Iraq's security crisis on the sidelines of nuclear talks this week, but the Pentagon says it will not coordinate potential military action with Tehran. President Barack Obama says he would consider military options for helping the Iraqi government push back the advance of Sunni Islamist militants. They've made more gains in the north over the last 24 hours. Somalia's Al-Shabaab Islamist group has claimed responsibility for an attack in Kenya that's left dozens of people dead. They were shot as they watched the World Cup on Sunday, with the attackers also targeting a hotel and a bank in Umpeketoni. At least 48 people were killed. Monocle's correspondent in Nairobi, Tristan McConnell, says the area would have been targeted deliberately.
This is an area that has for decades really been neglected, been marginalised, where security forces really don't provide much in the way of security to ordinary citizens. And in other parts of the northeast, we have seen attacks, not on this scale, but a similar style, attacks on banks, on police posts, on security installations. And so it fits within that context.
Ukraine's president says he's ordered troops to regain control of the frontier with Russia to pave the way for a truce and peace talks after weeks of fighting with pro-Russian separatists. Petro Poroshenko did not say how long the truce should last. His remarks underlined his concern that Russia is supporting the rebels by sending military equipment, something Moscow denies. Meanwhile, Ukraine says Russia has cut off all gas supply to the country as talks on a pricing deal collapsed. Russian natural gas exporter Gazprom said Kiev will now only get gas it pays for in advance. In Colombia, President Juan Manuel Santos has vowed to bring peace to the country after winning re-election. In a victory speech, he told Marxist rebels that his re-election shows that voters demand an end to 5 decades of war. Santos has staked his reputation on securing a peace deal with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. He opened talks with the group in late 2012 and last week revealed preliminary talks with a smaller rebel group, the National Liberation Army. A conference is underway in the United States discussing climate change and the impact on the world's oceans. Countries affected by rising sea levels in some parts of the globe have told the event in Washington about tide erosion, evacuation of villages, and destruction of food crops. Climate change was described as posing the greatest moral challenge of our time, and delegates said it's not a political issue. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has spoken at the event.
No one should mistake that the protection of our oceans is a vital international security issue. It's a vital security issue involving the movement of people, the livelihood of people, the capacity of people to exist and live where they live today.
The CEO of Qatar Airways says delivery of their first three Airbus A380 Super Jumbos has hit a further delay of several weeks due to unresolved cabin issues. The delivery had originally been expected around the end of May, coinciding with a meeting of global airlines in Qatar's capital, Doha, but that was pushed back after the airline apparently rejected the aircraft during a routine pre-delivery inspection. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed. David Moore News from David Spencer at the bottom of the hour. 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 exactly here in London, 13.06 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on the news of the day are both Robert Fox, Defence Editor at London's Evening Standard newspaper, and the London-based journalist Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the programme. We'll begin the programme and our conversation in Iraq, where America has floated the possibility of airstrikes and even close cooperation with its regional rival Iran to clamp down on a rapid campaign of territory snatching and violence from ISIS, the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Sunni insurgents. Samira and Robert will get into the geopolitics and related issues in a moment. But first, let's talk about photographs which have surfaced recently posted on an Islamic extremist group website showing hundreds of Iraqi military personnel in civilian clothing being led away near Tikrit to their execution. Additional photos show hundreds of dead bodies in a shallow grave. We'll get your views in a moment. Let's hear first, though, from Rebecca Collard in Erbil. Here's her report.
In the northern Iraqi town of Erbil, men watch the news of radical Islamist militants taking control of swaths of the country. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, a group too radical even for Al-Qaeda, now occupies two major Iraqi cities and are vowing to take the capital, Baghdad. This man says the Iraqi army has shown it is no match for ISIS. I think now we need the Americans to come back, he says. They got rid of Saddam. And that, in some capacity, may be on the agenda, as Washington mulls options on how to deal with the crisis and support its allies. In the meanwhile, hundreds of young Iraqi men are signing up to fight the radical Sunni militant group. They are answering a call to arms by the country's top Shia cleric, and this is likely to stoke already strong sectarian tensions. Hundreds of thousands have fled their homes. But even in these new refugee camps, there is sympathy for ISIS. This man sits in a tent in the Kurdish territory. He fled Mosul with his family as ISIS entered the city. But he prefers the Islamic militants to the Shia-led government of Nouri al-Maliki. Since al-Maliki took over power, he did nothing for us, he tells me. No services, just jailing people and oppressing people. But before the Shia oppressed the Sunnis oppressed the Shia and the Kurds. And some say it's this history that laid the groundwork for these events and the possible dividing of Iraq.
An event like this, like the ISIS takeover, is an actualization of this view of the three-part state. Because during Saddam's time and even before Saddam's time, the Sunnis were always the ones who ruled, and the Shiites and the Kurds were oppressed. Now the tables have turned.
With these sectarian calls to arms, radical ISIS controlling major cities, and violence spreading across the country, many here fear Iraq may fall to these sectarian divisions. From Monocle in northern Iraq, I'm Rebecca Collard.
And Robert Fox and Samira Shackle are with me in the studio. Robert, if I can start with you, do you think this kind of situation and the worsening on the ground there will prompt meaningful action from the US? What will it look like? And could it be, do you think, a broader cooperation with Iran? Could this be the thing that finally prompts those two powers to work a little more closely together?
As of this week, Iran is the big regional player.
because Iran is the only one that can be brought in with meaningful force and manpower to save the creaking, to put it mildly, regime of Nouri al-Maliki. But Iran will do it on Iran's terms, and they will probably get rid of Nouri al-Maliki. They will probably work through the clerisy, through, I mean, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani cannot be written out of this picture. He's a very, very old man, but extremely respected. And the people who are coming to protect him, Mqabala and Najaf, which is so important, are the old clan systems within the Shia. And guess who has reared his head again? Muqtadir al-Sadr, who has, although he is an Iraqi, and he makes it clear he's an Iraqi Arab, the al-Sadr clan and its clan interest really crosses the Gulf and goes into Iran. You asked me a question about America. I think we'll be hearing America and its president philosophizing yet again and again, even this time next week. They can move up the carrier into the Gulf, the George H.W. Bush with two escorts. But actually, the kind of language, just listen to Tony Blair over the weekend, of even surgical, restrained, cooperative interventionism. Sorry, that's last decade's language, and it didn't work then, because precision strike, just technically, is a grossly overdone instrument. There is bound to be collateral damage. And in the end, you have to secure something. You have to secure a space. And who are your allies going to be then? I think there will be a deal done with Iran if it's not done already. And Iran, under a very astute leadership, whether you approve of it or not, of Rouhani and Zarif, will want a very stiff price. They will want a deal on nuclear. We are in a very big change to the Middle East. Can I just draw the lens out? We are going back 98 years, because this is the settlement across central Syria, the Mesopotamian, because it wasn't Iraq then, and Persian space, which was settled between the Brits, the French, and the Russians, which people forget, with the Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1916, which became this sort of rather mishmash arrangement at Versailles 1919 into 1920, which produced Iraq and Syria. It's always been a demographic bluff because it favoured minorities against majorities. That bluff has now been called.
And Samira, it's interesting, isn't it? Robert suggests there that, you know, some sort of agreement involving the US is inevitable. How do you think Obama can sell the kind of compromises perhaps that Robert's suggesting there to people in the USA? Do you think he's capable of doing that? Do you think he's concerned to try and do that?
I think he will be certainly concerned with it, because he's already faced stiff criticism at home about having discussed the nuclear deal with Iran at all, about prioritising the diplomatic option at all in that respect. So, I mean, it would be also an absolutely huge thing. I mean, it's one thing to have backdoor talks about a nuclear deal. It's quite another thing to have overt military cooperation. And so I think the US will be very, very careful about how it proceeds. And I think it's not just within the US that it's a concern. There's also allies in the region. There's the Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia, who would hate to see their allies in the US cooperating with Iran in such an overt way. There's also Israel, who are already profoundly worried about the sort of talks that are going on around Iran's nuclear program. So I think it's something that would certainly be addressed with caution. But on the other hand, I think the US has ruled out troops on the ground, because that's seen as sort of politically unviable, both in Iraq and in the US. I don't think there's much public appetite for US boots on the ground 3 years after they left. So that sort of leaves them with airstrikes and cooperating with regional partners, I think. So I'm not really surprised that they're looking at all options.
And when we take that sort of pan-regional view, Robert, is it too soon to sort of look at who the ultimate sort of winners and losers are going to be? Obviously, the situation is so grave in Iraq that dominates people's short-term considerations. But in terms of that, the delicate balance between all of these complex players, you mentioned this century of complex history throughout the region. Will there be any people who are looking at this and sensing, I don't know, political opportunity?
Yes, very definitely. I'm sorry to say, and somebody in my job, sorry to be a bit self-regarding, I have to do these hierarchies every day, and they change. And they sometimes change within a day. Who is really gaining an initiative now? And absolutely, Samira was saying, that the great gainer technically in this opportunity, moment of opportunity, because there's a great vacuum that's been created by ISIS, is Iran. And Iran has the tactical and military know-how as to what to do. So you've got the Al-Quds leadership, the very, very forefront of guerrilla fighting in this kind of terrain. They're there in Baghdad, they're advising Maliki, and they're saying to Maliki quite clearly, I would paraphrase, it's us or your oblivion. And they are very important. The people who do sense an opportunity, and it's been a steady gain, and they have managed it on the whole, in their own terms, terribly well, is the Kurdish leadership. And it's very interesting how, and it is very significant in terms of regional politics and oil geopolitics, that the Kurds moved into Kirkuk over the weekend. And the other really big player, which is determined not to lose, and it's actually, in games playing terms, it's got a defence against the goal at the moment, is Turkey. Now, having said that, the big losers are potentially Lebanon and Jordan. And this is where I slightly disagree with Samira. I think that the Saudis, who are very ambivalent about this, they are scared. It's a gerontocracy. It's an ageing regime. They see they are terrified by the activities of ISIS and what reflection it could have with them. And they're going to hold their nose and they're going to deny it publicly. But they're really rather glad that Iran is holding Maliki together, because Iran is the guarantee, because these armed forces that the Brits and the Americans and the French primarily put together really can't fight outside their own territory, outside the territory of their kindred. And finally, we have to go to Israel, and we will hear a lot from Israel over the next three or four days. And they've been screaming. They're on my email. They're on the phone message. And, you know, the Netanyahu will be, I mean, there is a kind of almost hysteria coming out of Israel, because the bombing option against Iran, which the right wing in Israel has very much wanted, is coming off the table, probably forever.
Let's talk about, you mentioned already the rhetoric of Tony Blair over the weekend. I want to talk about him in a little more detail. He's received a lot of new focus because of what he's been saying. Of course, we remember his involvement back in 2003. He's posted an essay as well as his media appearances. And he's once again repeated this idea that it's impossible to sort of blame sectarian violence, which he says is very deep-rooted, on any sort of Western activity from 2003 onwards. Samira, do you set much store by that? Do you think he's being slightly disingenuous and that actually there is more of a direct case perhaps for him to answer?
I think he's certainly being disingenuous. I think he sets people's backs up by not accepting any responsibility. I mean, it's ludicrous to say that sort of invading a country and displacing the leader has some effect on later violence. That's just certainly true. I think there's sort of limited use in finger pointing and blaming really at this point. And that's, I think, the reason that Tony Blair's interventionist was so unhelpful, just because it completely detracts attention from a lot of really important things that do need to be discussed. And if it becomes a sort of a finger pointing game and sort of people trying to outdo themselves with counterfactual versions of, you know, Tony Blair dedicated a portion of his essay to sort of what would have happened if Saddam had been still in power and then the Arab Spring had come and so on and so on. And I think that's not a particularly useful game, because you can't really, no one can say what would have happened if things that have happened hadn't happened, as it were. So it's, I think it's sort of, it's a slightly depressing turn into sort of partisan sniping in the UK, when I think there's much more important things to be discussed.
It's an interesting point there, Robert, isn't that sort of counterfactual notion? Do you think Tony Blair should just pipe down and leave the main actors to get on with this? Or do you think that there are some people who actually do still welcome a contribution from him?
No, as Samira said, it's a grossly self-indulgent exercise with some shrewdness behind it, because I think if the Chilcot inquiry into Iraq halfway does his job, that he will be regarded as culpable. What is so worrying about Blair, and this does extend to other things, is his insouciance, his lack of contextual awareness. He doesn't understand the Middle East. He doesn't understand Iran. He's made lots of money there. I mean, that is undeniable. But in fact, I devoted my column today in the Evening Standard to this, and I said the thing where Bush and Blair are most culpable is that every major strategist and military thinker says you must adjust your plan not your strategy, your policy, your program, your overall political vision, according to facts on the ground as they change. The disaster, which I said was almost willful incompetence, was disbanding the Iraqi army and disbanding the Ba'athist apparatus, because that disbanded anything from a hospital administration to a primary school right the way through. Blair doesn't recognise this at all. Blair was right. Peter Stoddart, who sat with him for 30 days as he prepared to go to war and declared war, had sent British troops into Iraq in 2003, former editor of the Times, said very tellingly when he was asked a year later why he thought Blair did it because he could. It was a rush of blood to his head. He could not change his mind. We all knew 6 weeks before there were no weapons of mass destruction primed and ready to go, because the Hans Blix's teams had known it. That is typical of Blair. Don't confuse me with the facts. This is my vision. And that is why I don't think it's just Blair, by the way. I think this is symptomatic of the kind of displacement that's going on. And let's focus on the UK. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, is being much, much criticised, and I think with justification, because he's a philosopher like Obama, not nearly as clever, and he comes up with airy persiflage, what Boris Johnson, his fellow Tory party member, would call just piffle. And in the end, what has he been doing over the weekend? He's been parading with Angelina Jolie, to whom the Brits have given an honour because of raising consciousness about rape in warfare, which is a serious issue. But it is not the prime issue of the Foreign Secretary when two areas of vital interest to the UK are blowing up, namely Eastern Europe in Kiev and Ukraine, and Baghdad and the central heartland of what we now must call ISIS land, because the borders drawn up, to go back to that famous thing of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the most famous one, was drawn with an architect's rule, literally, was a line, not in the sand, on the map, between Syria and Iraq. That has gone. It is now ISIS land for the time being. And what Mr. Hague, it is far worse than what Mr. Obama has said. What he is saying to me seems to have no traction and relevance whatsoever as to what we should be thinking about now. And he should be thinking very seriously, because my serious friends in the city, the top end of market analysts in journalism in the UK, saying we are heading within days to a very serious oil crisis.
Those are the insights of Robert Fox. Samira Shackle is with us as well. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we'll be looking to Pakistan and Ukraine, so stay tuned.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monaco shop.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me, the London-based journalist Samira Shackle and Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard newspaper. Let's turn now to North Waziristan, where a full-scale military operation is underway to push out insurgent forces. Fighter jets today hit targets in the region. Troops, gunships and artillery have been rolled out for the fight. Last week, of course, saw an attack on Pakistan's biggest airport. Samira, let's start with you. How grave is this situation? Perhaps not getting the coverage it might otherwise have done. Certainly the airport attack did. But these latest developments, maybe, you know, falling away from front pages, should we be concerned about that?
Well, I think it's certainly significant in the context of sort of Pakistan's way of dealing with the Taliban, with the terrorist threat. So since the last government was voted into power last May, there's been a big emphasis on peace talks. It's a conservative right-wing government. And during the election campaign, the sort of two main right-wing parties were sort of both advocating talks with the Taliban. And that's something that's been pursued with not much success. And I think increasingly, the public, bigger and bigger portions of the public have been saying, well, why are we pursuing peace talks when the attacks have gone on unabated, basically? You know, there's been a huge loss of life since the peace process, so-called peace process, began. And that sort of begged the question for many people of how do you sit around a negotiating table when the basic starting point of one group is the destruction of the other and the destruction of the state? And that's what the sort of view of the Taliban is. And so I think it's sort of in the balance of power in the Pakistani state that the army has been calling for harsh military action, a full-scale military operation, which we're now seeing in Waziristan for months and months now. And the government, the civilian government's been resisting in favour of talks. And I think the airport attack basically put paid to the idea that talks could work. And indeed, even when peace talks have been pursued in the past, the Taliban have always broken the ceasefire. So I think it was inevitable that this would happen eventually. It's just sort of a shame it's taken so much loss of civilian life to get there.
And just on the Karachi attack, I mean, how dangerous is Karachi as a place? Because there was a sort of a feeling that this was, you know, a new boundary, a new escalation, and perhaps that attack was almost symbolic because of what it represented. I mean, is it that sort of place?
Well, Karachi is a dangerous place. I mean, I lived in Karachi. It's not it's certainly, you don't feel safe. That's a lot to do with crime, gang violence, as a sort of poor law and order. It's a huge population to the number of police, basically. So that's, you're sort of more worried about, I think, sort of gun crime than you are about terrorism. But because of that sort of law and order vacuum, there has increasingly been a sort of terrorist base there. So I think that there's been a sense that it's a matter of time before a big attack in Karachi happens. I mean, the sort of adage in Pakistan used to be, you commit a crime in Karachi, you go and you hide in Waziristan. Now you commit a crime in Waziristan, you hide in Karachi, because there just isn't the sort of manpower in the police force to manage that kind of urban insurgency. So I think it's been, but it was still a shock. I mean, an airport is always a shock. That airport particularly, it's a big airport. It feels very secure when you're in it. It's sort of Pakistan's window to the world. It's much, much bigger than the airports in Lahore or Islamabad, the other two main cities. So I think it was a real, despite the fact that Karachi is a very volatile city, there was a real sense of shock that it sort of, if it can happen there, nowhere's safe.
So, Robert, what have you made of the general handling then of the insurgent threat, specifically within Pakistan? Tremendous challenges. Is it one that's being faced with a great deal of, I don't know what you'd call it, competence by the government? Do you have graver concerns about the overall strategy, perhaps?
Well, there is a bit of a problem in that there has been within the Pakistan establishment, particularly the military establishment and the ISI, a certain amount of ambivalence towards the Taliban, because the Taliban, to some extent, were a very useful tool, particularly in keeping Afghanistan unstable. Very important to keep Afghanistan unstable, because this is what's known as strategic depth. This is the way you can keep India on its toes, and it goes through Kashmir. And unfortunately, Kashmir is still not resolved, and a lot of these extreme groups, Taliban groups, are related to that. I agree with Samir. I haven't been in the region for really quite some time, but the way I read it, through friends, colleagues, is that this is a bit of a wake-up call, because, as she rightly said, the attack on Karachi airport, and it's very interesting, they went back and did it twice to make the propaganda point. And this is a real challenge to the command of the Pakistan military and the ISI. What are you really going to do? Because there is a thesis abroad now, particularly promoted by Carlotta Gall in her new book, called The Wrong Enemy, that the ISI was really running the serious bits of Taliban insurgency across the south and southwest of Afghanistan. And therefore, people like Musharraf, remember him, general coup, becomes president, were being very ambivalent, deliberately ambivalent, and I'm being polite there. What she really meant was two-faced in saying to Bush, I'm with you on the global war on terror, but meanwhile, ISI, keep on stirring it up over there. This is a very dangerous game of playing off sides against each other, and they have come to a decision point. There's no doubt about it, and it's the next subject that we're going to talk about, which is related to this, is that something does appear to be on the move. We are at a real turning point in Afghanistan, and Taliban doesn't look now, although it's violent, whatever, to be primarily a problem in Afghanistan, as it is a prime problem now to the security, as Samira said, of urban Punjabi as well as frontier Pakistan. It's in all the provinces now, and it's not necessarily Pashtun national based. And this is the thing, it is a genuine urban terrorist movement or insurgent movement. And this is where what you've just described in the airport attacks, it's a real wake-up call.
Samira, just finally on this and briefly before we finish, what happens next? If peace talks are off the table, and I think we probably agree that that's definitely going to happen, what's the next step? It seems like a fairly bleak picture that's confronting the administration there. What do you think they're going to... Well, it's hard to second-guess them. What do you think they might try next?
Well, it's difficult, I think. There's been... this is a full-scale military operation, so that might sort of have some sort of temporary effect, but it's not the first time that there's been a full-scale military operation. There was a big military operation in 2009 to push the Taliban out of Swat, and there's actually been a military presence in that border region ever since. And we're talking tens of thousands of troops, so it's not... it's been ramped up, but it's a region that's notoriously difficult to tame, and that's the reason it's the sort of federally administered tribal area. It's not covered by the jurisdiction of the state because successive governments and militaries have been unable to. And I think since it became a sort of safe haven for global terrorist movements in 2001 after the invasion of Afghanistan by the US, it's been increasingly evident that how difficult it is to police because the border is so porous. I mean, you have a Pakistani military operation on the Pakistani side of the border. It's an incredibly porous border, people, and quite a hostile landscape. People can sort of cross over and into Afghanistan, take stock there, cross over again. So it will be interesting to see what happens. But I think a lot of people aren't that hopeful. And I think a lot of people are quite worried within Pakistan because last time there was a military offensive, there were attacks and the rest of the country was stepped up. The Taliban have said they're going to step up attacks and particularly targeting foreign firms and foreign interests in the country. They've said they're at a state of war.
Concerning times indeed. We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Samira Shackle and Robert Fox, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Our editor Andrew Tuck talks about urban gentrification. We'll meet Henrik Brandau of Johnson to discuss his book, Jogo Bonit, and we'll review the latest art exhibitions in Italy. But before we get started on that, here's David Spencer with the latest world news headlines.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. The United States has again indicated it could work with Iran on helping Iraq battle a rampage across the country by Sunni insurgents. US Secretary of State John Kerry said he wouldn't rule anything that would be constructive. Militants have made great gains across Iraq over the last couple of weeks. Russia has cut off gas to Ukraine in a dispute over unpaid bills that could disrupt supplies to the rest of Europe. Moscow says Ukraine would now only get gas it has paid for in advance. Somali-linked Islamists have claimed responsibility for killing at least 50 people in a Kenyan coastal town. The Al-Shabaab group said its commandos launched Sunday night's strike because Kenya had sent its forces to Somalia and accused Nairobi of assassinating Muslim scholars. Pakistani fighter jets have pounded North Waziristan a day after the army announced the start of a full-scale military operation to flush Islamist insurgents out of the volatile region bordering Afghanistan. The army said 27 insurgents were killed. A spokesman for the German motor racing star Michael Schumacher says the former Formula One world champion is no longer in a coma and has been moved to a hospital in Switzerland. The 46-year-old has been in an induced coma in hospital since hitting his head on a rock in a skiing accident in the French Alps in December. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David Spencer. More news at the top of the hour. That's 1900 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Now, as the new edition of Monocle magazine hits the newsstands, we're looking all this week at our annual Quality of Life survey. Today, our editor Andrew Tuck asks, as the fallout from gentrification hits harder, is it too late to act?
There's a contradiction in the very heart of great city living. On the one hand, we are drawn to big cities, Paris, Sao Paulo, Tokyo, Sydney, because they teem with great jobs, people to date, chances to vanish, endless cultural pleasures, and something new around every corner. But to have quality of life in a city, you also need the shortest possible journey time between the beacons in your day, home, work, gym, bar. Somehow, you need the big city to work like a little town, unless you enjoy sitting in traffic or getting home 2 hours after you left the office. And that's an increasing problem in many wealthy cities, Monocle's hometown of London included. As the glow of gentrification spreads across the city, followed by waves of global capital looking for somewhere to rest, it pushes before it anyone who has not already secured a home or a handsome salary. Suddenly, your conversations with people hunting for their first apartment include mention of neighbourhoods you'd struggle to locate on a tube map. Remind me again, where is South where the fuck? The distances between work and home for many citizens become ever longer. Of course, metropoles have long been surrounded by suburbs and commuter belts whose siren call was heard by the broody and people who fancied owning a fish pond. But there was always a place in the city, in the heart of the city, for the new arrival who was willing to share a flat or squeeze their life into a bedsit. But the places that not even a generation ago were on the flat hunt list of new arrivals have now upped their prices and ambitions, planted their window boxes and stuck two fingers up at anyone without a daddy to bankroll them. The problem is further exacerbated by a trend that's key to modern city demographics. Let's call them the urban silver foxes and foxettes. When people used to hit a certain age in a city, and if they had the resources, they would experience a kind of property menopause. They would reach their 40s, get a bit unnerved by all the noise and dirt, and decide that actually they'd be better off somewhere leafy. But now, many of those buying and renting in the city are middle-aged people making the reverse journey, residents who have had enough of stretch links between those daily beacons. Why live in a narrow-minded commuter village when you can have a home in a great apartment block that has its own gym and pool and is just 10 minutes walk from your office? And so they sell up, move ever closer to the heart of the action. They lead the lives they wanted in their 20s. All of this is causing an inversion of how cities look. In the heart of the city, you find rising numbers of middle-class and middle-aged people. In many suburbs, you find the young, the new migrants, and the poorer off. In the centre of the city, you have all the services you desire. In the suburbs, you don't. Now, some people would say we can engineer our way out of this, but gentrification is almost unstoppable, and the tides of fashionability are equally difficult to deflect. Just look at what happens when you try to help suburbs by improving their transport links. Suddenly they become wildly popular and the people who live there get priced out once again. So we have to cope with these tensions as best as possible. We can try to control rents or insist on building smaller, more affordable units in the centres of our cities. We can create more mixed-use developments where you can live close to your work. We can make sure the suburbs and outer neighbourhoods have their fair share of culture. But, well, the but is in the future, the people who will enjoy having their lives contained within a few blocks will increasingly be the well-off. Luxury will be defined as not having a nice car for the commute, but only requiring a bicycle to get you around your big city village.
That was Andrew Tuck on urban gentrification. His essay for the latest edition of Monocle magazine, hitting newsstands very soon. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show. Another instalment coming your way. Up next, World Cup time.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Win Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's 18:44 here in London. Now, music in the Middle East is dominated by big flashy commercial acts, Nancy Ajram, Haifa Wahiba, powerful pop icons. But over the past decade or so, new sounds have begun emerging from the region, and Lebanon in particular, electropop, indie rock, blues, artists who got their start performing at bars, not weddings. Of the dozens of indie bands forming and breaking up in the Middle East, only a handful ever reach a Western audience. From Beirut, Susanna George has this report on Lebanon's budding indie music scene and what it takes to make it big in the West.
On a Sunday night in the Lebanese capital, a crowd's gathering at one of the city's newest music venues, Music Hall on the Waterfront. It's decidedly laid back. Many men and women are sporting t-shirts and Converse sneakers. They're here to see a local girl made good, Yasmin Hamdan. She's back in town in the middle of a tour to promote the release of her solo album, Yanas. Next up, a sold-out show in London. But for now, she's back home in Beirut. Hamdan's being called one of the most groundbreaking artists working in the Middle East today. Unlike the commercial Arabic pop that dominates radio stations here, her sound is underground and bare. It's a sound she first pioneered nearly 20 years ago, alongside Zaid Hamdan, under the name Soapkills, as Beirut was recovering from decades of civil war.
When we started Soapkills in Beirut, it was really, really, really the beginning. And I'm saying the beginning, like, we didn't even have electricity sometimes for days. So I'm talking about a period where you didn't even have a pub. You know, you had one guy who had material that you could run from him, and not even a sound engineer.
Soapkills combined classical Arabic music with electro and trip-hop, creating a new sound, something people had never heard before. This track, Wadeh, is from the 2002 album Shiftuk. But quickly, Hamdan says she began to feel claustrophobic in Beirut.
It was very difficult because we didn't fit any format, you know, and even here in Beirut, you know, Arabic radios would consider this non-Arabic. And English-speaking radios, they just don't want to promote or put any Arabic bands, even if they're doing modern or actuals, you know, music or with an actual sound.
In the early 2000s, Hamdan left to Paris to pursue a solo career. But today, more than 10 years later, the indie music movement she helped pioneer is coming into its own. Over the past few years, alternative rock band Mashruleila has been rising to prominence both regionally and in the West. Wielding a magnetic blend of edgy lyrics and an approachable sound, they've graced the cover of Rolling Stone and wrapped up a European tour. At the center of the indie music scene sits a small dark bar along the main street of the Mar Mikhail neighborhood called Radio Beirut. Here, in addition to her day job in marketing, Christine Abiasi helps host a weekly radio show dedicated to discovering new local music talent. She says she was shocked by how many new indie bands there are in Beirut these days, but only a few achieve success in the West, or even regionally. For that, she says it comes down to sales just as much as sound.
I think the ones who do are the ones who have a proper band manager. And second of all, they have some type of marketing profile which is like some way attractive or cool in the West.
For example, with Mashruleila, she says some of that cool marketing profile was that their lyrics dealt with homosexuality. Zaid Hamdan is the other half of Soapkills. He still lives in Beirut, working as a composer and producer.
The music scene is vibrant.
The artists have so much things to express and they're all here, but there is the step after that, the producer step, the production side that is non-existent.
He's talking about music studios, venues, even artist-friendly copyright laws.
There is no structures to value this alternative scene. The only structures there are only promote the big names, the Arabic pop stars, or the bands that succeeded internationally.
For example, the venue where Yasmin Hamdan performed on the Beirut waterfront, that's not open to new local talent. They only host artists who've already achieved success abroad.
I used to say, stay in your country, do something for your scene. I used to say that to the musicians. Today, I have to tell them, go out as soon as you can. The first opportunity, pack and leave.
And that's something that Lebanese indie bands finding success abroad have in common. They found ways to get out and tour early on in their careers. Zaid says he's thrilled to see the variety of music coming out of Lebanon these days. But he says if he could have one wish, it would be that the music would be a little less clean and a bit more angry.
I wish for the Middle East more punk bands. Where is this youth that expressed this disgust for this incredibly unfair and disastrous social situation in which we live? Where are those people? Why are all our artists dirty enough to be cool, but not dareful enough? This is the idols I look for. I want our local Pixies or David Bowie or Sex Pistols.
That, he says, is the kind of music he wants to produce. Unfortunately, despite all the turmoil in the Middle East, all the corruption and violence worthy of outrage, he admits he doesn't see truly rebellious music on the horizon.
I'm really shocked, you know. We just produce very polite and clean people, you know. They're going with the system as if we don't believe in revolution anymore. You know, we just want to exist, do our thing, express politely and create no trouble.
For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Susanna George.
Ticking towards the top of the hour, and you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, we were talking about the beautiful game a little earlier. It's time to continue our cultural and aesthetic nourishment now with a trip to some of the finest galleries in Italy. For today, we're talking art in Rome, Venice and Florence. Joining me now on the line is Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor of Corriere della Sera. Luca, good evening to you. Thanks very much indeed for joining us. Quite a tour, a cultural tour we're going on through Italy. We'll start in Rome and Pasolini Roma. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Yeah, hi everybody. Yeah, it's maybe the best portrait. It's a sort of double portrait of a city and, I mean, about Rome in the last century, and one of the greatest prophets of Italian culture, Pasolini, Pier Paolo Pasolini. And so if you love Rome, if you love cinema, Pasolini was a great filmmaker, also a poet, an artist, an intellectual, a sort of zombie of the Italian culture, because he's dead in the 75, but he's still alive because everyone quotes his sentences and watch the film. So if you want to see Rome like a novel, an erratic novel, because Pasolini was an homosexual, a communist, a little bit Catholic, and fighting with the church, with the Communist Party, so was a clash of cultures. And you can see from the beginning when he came in Rome in the 15th, in the 50s and till the end, and with his tragic death close to the sea at Ostia, you can see him playing football in the suburbs with some guys, or talking with Federico Fellini about a film. It's a sort of novel of Rome by a particular perspective. It's a really irregular intellectual and artist, and I love this exposition. I can say that is the Palazzo delle Esposizioni, and until the end of July. So if you want to know something deep about Rome and the clash between modernity and tradition, maybe it's a really good way.
It sounds absolutely wonderful. Let's cross to Venice, though, next. The Architecture Biennale. Talk to us about this, because it's unfolding for a long time. 6 months, is that right? And it's sort of about architecture rather than architects. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a little bit institutional, yeah, this suggestion, I like it because the director, Rem Koolhaas, the Dutch architect, I like his theory about junk space, and it's interesting to see all the world, because we have new countries participating from Costa Rica, Dominican Republic, United Arab Emirates, Indonesia, Kenya, Morocco, Mozambique, New Zealand, and Turkey. So new countries that have to figure out the form and how to build something, because the main pavilion is about elements of architecture. Is in this edition you can look at the fundamentals of the buildings, the floor, the wall, the ceiling, the roof, the door, the window, and the philosophy of Rem Koolhaas, as I say, junk space, is that we can't fight against modernity. We have to rethink it. And so Venice, you can go every time in Venice, and maybe this time is something deeper than only contemporary art or cinema exhibition. That's it. Great and cool, but it's something more, maybe a philosophic way of thinking the contemporary art, just like contemporary architecture.
It's another fascinating one, Luca, which I'll mark down on my to-do list. We're a bit short of time, though. I wanted to ask you about Florence, Pontormo and Rosso Fiorentino, two great innovators. Tell us about this one in Florence. What will we find here?
Yeah, this is a classic you can find in Palazzo Strozzi, and it's the first time we have the masterpiece of these great painters restored. So it's really interesting because it's a sort of double exhibition. In fact, the title completely is Diverging Paths of Mannerism, because they were in the same school of Andrea del Sarto, but just like different twins, because Pontormo was the favorite of the Medici, the most powerful family in Florence, and Rosso with other family, and so they were a little influenced by the different family to be connected, and we can see the holy light of the Renaissance and something more mysterious, because especially in Pontormo you have influenced by Kabbalistic literature and esoteric works, so it's a little eccentric than the classic, like Michelangelo or Leonardo. It's nice, and the color are great. You can see red and blue. It's great. I suggest this exposition, and I think it's until the end of July too, this exhibition.
Wonderful stuff. Luca, thank you so much. You've painted a beautiful picture in words there for us. That was Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor of Corriere della Sera. And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. A special thanks to Robert Fox and Samira Shackle, my guests a little earlier. The show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra Stenbrock-Fermor. My studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Culture with Robert Bound is next. We're back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours. For now, goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.